Chapter 15. The Tea Chest. Lestrade and his wife have barely spoken since he surprised her in his blood-stained clothes. It's amazing how a long-married couple can dance around each other in even a close and limited space. It isn't that they've ignored each other deliberately. A subtle shift in their movements has managed to separate them, so that Effie has been going out just as Lestrade has come in. One has gone to bed early while the other has worked late. A few muttered words in the corridor or the kitchen have managed to replace any serious conversation. Meanwhile, Ollie, normally the cause of so much tension between them, has had a good week. He's slept better. He has his appetite. He's even gone back to school. So when Lestrade comes down to breakfast the next morning, he is pleased to see Effie waiting for him. She seems to be in a better mood. There's a percolator with proper coffee waiting for him on the table, and she's already been out and bought his favourite cinnamon buns. The house is south-facing, and sunlight streams in across the square. He kisses her on the cheek and sits down opposite her. "You were in late last night," she begins, but for once it is not an accusation, just a statement of fact. "I had to call America. It took hours to get a line. These days, there are so many satellites down, either literally or in the sense of broken beyond repair, that most of the transatlantic calls are made using the ancient undersea cables." "America? That's unusual." "I needed to speak to someone, a possible witness." In the old days, he would have told her everything about his investigation, how he has been trying to chase the payments made to Finn Hudson and Silas Welburn via the office of a crooked solicitor, now dead, called Cornelius Sutro. His aim is to find the source, but the trail has so far led him nowhere. Sutro used codes and acronyms to disguise his clients' names. There are shell accounts, fake accounts, Swiss banks, offshore banks. It would take a team of forensic financial investigators months to make sense of it all. But it's been a long while since the serious fraud office was shut down, principally because there weren't any businesses left that weren't committing that particular crime, but mainly because the worst offenders were too huge to be touched. So he had focused investigation instead on Dost Akbar, who in the days before his death had been afraid of a secret meeting that he was about to attend, something that his assistant, Samantha Jones, had called a summit. Dost was afraid of the Red Circle. It was Lestrade who had discovered the vital clue that had led him to Baker Street. Could the summit in some way be connected to the Red Circle? Samantha had mentioned a PA in New York, and that was the person who Lestrade, helped by Hopkins, had spent the last 18 hours trying to track down. With success. They spoke yesterday. The PA, shocked and cut adrift by her boss's death, told him everything. But Effie doesn't want to hear any of this. "I hope I didn't wake you up," Lestrade says. "I have something for you," Effie says, brightly. She reaches down and produces an A4 manila envelope which she has already opened. Lestrade sees that it has been sent from Brighton. "Is this from Susanna?" he asks. "Actually, it was Michael who sent it." The scowling brother-in-law. Lestrade takes out a glossy brochure. The cover shows a modern factory made up of quite handsome white buildings with the sea in the background. An inset shows a delicious cut of meat. The words on the cover: "Boss meat, the future of healthy nutrition." "Boss meat?" Lestrade frowns. "Don't they make meat out of..."
"Insects, yes, but you don't need to make that face, George. Insects have been part of the human diet since the beginning of time."
Suddenly she sounds like the primary school teacher that she once was.
"Moths and butterflies, locusts, mealworms, they're healthier than conventional meat, more cost-effective and better for the planet. You know the side effect from grazing cattle and poultry as well as the cruelty. By the end of the last century, factory farming had become disgusting, indefensible."
She nods at the brochure.
"Crickets contain 100% protein," she assures him. "Locusts have more iron per milligram than beef."
"Are you proposing we change our diet?" Lestrade asks.
"You know what I'm talking about. They're looking for a head of security at their New Haven plant, near Brighton. The job comes with a house and a car, and it'll pay twice what you're earning now. There are fantastic schools down there, and the sea air will do wonders for Ollie's health."
She looks at him plaintively.
"Please tell me you'll consider it."
Head of security.
Lestrade opens the brochure at random and finds himself looking at a photograph of about 1,000 blowflies buzzing around in a plastic box, trapped, which is how he feels.
I agree, it sounds very tempting, he demurs. But would they consider me?
Michael has a friend in HR. He mentioned your name and they said they'd be more than happy to hear from you.
That's very kind of him. Lestrade wants to add, he could have asked me first.
But he's choosing his words carefully.
Do you think I'd be happy as head of security in a meat factory? He asks.
I know you'd be safe, and I'd be happy.
Well, I'll think about it. He puts the brochure down.
That means you've already decided against it.
No, Effie.
Suddenly Lestrade is filled with an overwhelming sense of sadness. He and Effie have been together for half their lives. Neither of them has been unfaithful. They have seldom argued. When did they begin to drift apart? Why didn't he notice? I love you, he says. I love Ollie. I want what's best for both of you. But I've been doing this job all my life. You know my dad was a detective before me. You're asking me to give it up, but of course I'll think about it, if that's what will make you happy. But you can't ask me to drop everything right away. 390 people died in Richmond Park last week, murdered. 300 of them were on the plane, the rest of them were rough sleepers. Like it or not, I seem to have stumbled onto the biggest case of my career, and just one more week, even a few days, may allow me to solve it. I'm that close. I can't look at this now. You can't ask me to, but I promise you, when it's all over, I'll go and talk to Boss Meat and see what they have to say. He draws a breath. There's something else he has to tell her. And I've met someone, he says.
Who?
Her eyes widen. Is it another woman?
His name is Sherlock Holmes. He's been helping me, and I don't know why I say this, Effie, but there's something about him. He could be what I've been searching for all these years. Someone who can make my job make sense.
Sherlock Holmes? That's an unusual name.
There's nothing about him that's ordinary. You met him. He was the man in the ambulance that night.
At the river?
Yes. He shouldn't even have survived, but he pulled through and... I met him a couple of days ago. Somehow he's ended up chasing the same people as me. I think, together, we're going to bring them down.
Effie gives him a sad smile. But at least it is a smile. That's how it always is with you, George, she says. It doesn't matter what I say or what happens to Ollie, it always comes back to the job.
That's not true. I care for you more than anything else in the world, both of you. I'm just asking for 2 more days.
2 days.
And then I'll go to New Haven.
She pours him some coffee and picks up the plate of buns. Have one of these.
He takes one and tries to enjoy it, but it tastes dry in his mouth.
Meanwhile, in West Norwood, Missy is having breakfast with Susan Tarleton. Against all the odds, the two women have become friends, and as they tuck into fresh boiled eggs, local chickens, homemade bread rolls, stewed apples and tea, the atmosphere between them is pleasant and easygoing. Missy is dressed in trousers and Wellington boots, which she has borrowed from Susan. She has been out for a 1 mile walk, enjoying the fresh air of the suburbs outside the centre of town. It's only since she's come here that she's realised the quality of the air she's been breathing all her life. You'd have thought with less traffic and almost no aircraft, pollution in the city would have dropped. But it's one of the paradoxes of modern life that the fog and foul air of Victorian times has managed to make a return. And actually the streets are worse than ever. West Norwood isn't exactly country living, but it has got plenty of trees and parks. The good weather helps. Susan is still in her dressing gown. She usually leaves the house mid-morning, and she won't set foot outside the door without a full face of makeup and an eye-catching outfit that will catch the eye of the customers at the Black Swan. Looking at her now, Missy has to admit that she is very striking, attractive in the true sense of the word. Susan is also impetuous, willful, and incapable of taking advice or following instructions. In other words, a free spirit. She understands what Finn saw in her. And it is Finn that has brought them together. Susan wasn't working last night, and the two of them opened a bottle of wine and stayed up late, swapping stories about the wicked man they had both been foolish enough to fall for. Susan started it. There was the time Finn persuaded her to break into the garden of one of the big houses backing onto Dulwich Park because he wanted to swim in the pool. The two of them had stripped off, but before they'd even dipped a toe in, they'd been chased off by a German Shepherd guard dog and had to walk home in their underwear. So Missy weighed in with the night they went dancing in Soho, then walked back through Trafalgar Square. Skint from buying a ridiculously expensive bottle of champagne, Finn had insisted on gathering the coins people had thrown into the fountains to buy kebabs from one of the very unsavory kiosks. Missy had refused to share in the proceeds of a crime, which was why she hadn't succumbed to the food poisoning that had poleaxed him for a week. Susan had laughed at that one. Missy had other stories too, but these she kept to herself. Finn bursting into tears when he saw her walking down the aisle at St. Paul's Church in Covent Garden. The night she twisted her ankle, leaving a restaurant, and he carried her all the way home to Baker Street. Or all those times he woke up from bad dreams, and she held him until he had stopped trembling. Finn was the love of her life, until he wasn't anymore. But she doesn't blame Susan. It just happened to be her who stole Finn away. Could have been anyone. Sometimes you can wear a memory out by remembering. For weeks after Finn died, Missy could see his face so clearly, but then it seemed to drift away from her. She could still remember each of his features, his wide mouth, his blue eyes, his crooked, once broken nose. But they wouldn't resolve themselves into his face, and she would have to look at old photographs to bring him back. And now? However hard she tries, squeezing her eyes shut and concentrating until her head aches, he evades her, giving tantalizing glimpses of a smile or a glance that melt away as soon as they've formed. Oh, he was a bad man, all right. But he was a lovely one. He brightened both their lives. "So what are you going to do today?" Susan asks, lighting her first cigarette of the day. "I don't know. I'll read. I'll go over to the stables. I might even try riding. I've never sat on a horse in my life, but Terry said he'd give me a try." Terry is the stable boy she first met when she came to West Norwood. "Are you going to speak to John?" John Watson. Missy and Susan have talked a little about him, about Baker Street, but with Finn still in her mind, the question is somehow jarring, almost inappropriate. "I wasn't planning to," she says. "But you like him." That's Susan for you. Utterly direct. To the point. "Is it true?" "Yes. She does like him. At St. Thomas's Hospital, he was one of the few people she could always rely on. Positive, helpful, trying to do his best. She knew he had his demons, but at work he was a different man. That first night with Sherlock Holmes, for example, that was typical John Watson, going out of his way to perform an illegal operation at the risk of his career, and hers for that matter, to save a man he had never met before. She had never told him how proud she was of him that night. Of course, she wasn't happy. She was nearly thrown out. But he had batted for her too. Saved her job, saved Sherlock, saved everyone except himself. "I do like him," she agrees. "I like both of them." "How long are you going to let them stay?" It's a good question, and one that Missy has been asking herself. 221 Baker Street felt very empty after Finn abandoned her. She was grateful to have a roof over her head, but she had never felt more alone. Getting home from her shift to a snatched breakfast of beans on toast, and then to bed in an empty home. She's enjoying having breakfast with people to talk to, going to sleep with the murmur of voices, joining in with the two of them, trying to work out the mystery that has taken over their lives. Sherlock Holmes fascinates her. She's never met anyone like him, and it's not just his miraculous recovery from a life-threatening wound. He seems to have come from another planet. She doesn't fancy him, though. But John? Dr. John Watson? Ex-soldier and medical officer from Afghanistan? John too nervous to tell her what he thinks about her? Too shy and awkward to accept what should be painfully obvious? What would Finn say? The two of them couldn't be more different. The original chalk and cheese. Sitting there at the breakfast table with Susan Tarleton, she realizes she doesn't want him to leave. "I don't know," she replies to Susan's question. "The house is really much too big for one person. If John could run his surgery from there, he had one patient look in. He could pay me rent, and I need the money. You know what hospital wages are like. And Sherlock? He's very clever. Maybe he could help people too. It's a funny setup, the three of you. Yes, but I like it. I'm happy with them there. I really am. A bit later, Susan goes to work, and Missy is left on her own. She reads a few pages of the book she has brought with her, but she can't focus on the words. She's still thinking about Finn. She has a sudden urge to see him again. She heads to the cozy bedroom at the top of the house that she has been using since her arrival. It's small, but it has a view over a row of allotments and gardens with terraced houses on the other side. Susan has the larger bedroom on the floor below, and despite what she was saying earlier, Missy is careful never to look in, not to catch sight of the bed which her husband shared with his lover. She thinks about Finn. The box that Sherlock and John brought back to Baker Street contained only financial documents and a few photographs they wouldn't show her. But she's sure that Finn took more with him when he left. He was always one for old postcards, even meal receipts and used tickets. There must be more photographs as well. He liked happy memories. Where would he have kept them? And would Susan have destroyed them after the terrible accident that led to his death? She looks up. The bedroom is built into the eaves of the house, but there is still a small attic. She can see the outline of a trap door. She stands on the bed and pushes it open, gazes into an irregular space filled with cardboard boxes, piles of old clothes, cobwebs. Grasping both sides of the trap door, she pulls herself up. Susan's whole life is here. There are stuffed toys from her childhood, pictures she no longer wants to hang but can't bring herself to throw away, suitcases packed with clothes that are now too small for her, a broken sewing machine waiting futilely for repair. There doesn't seem to be anything that will help her, and she's about to get up when she spots, far back against the wall, a dark-coloured box fastened with elastic bands. Lowering herself onto her stomach, she wriggles underneath the sloping roof, and manages to hook her fingertips around a corner, drawing the box towards her. It's a long shoebox for riding boots, and the label says, MISC. She carries it back down to the bedroom, unhooks the bands, and lifts the lid. The first thing she finds is an iPad, one of the later models, with a horizontal, not a vertical, display, powered by nanobolt lithium tungsten batteries. Even though it has been in the attic for years, it bursts into life when she turns it on, and better still, it recognizes her voice. Show images, she says. There are hundreds of them. Considering the carelessness with which Finn treated his relationships, he seems to have been a sentimentalist at heart. He has kept every photo ever snapped of the pair of them, and some she didn't even know had been taken. There are wedding photographs and pictures taken during their honeymoon in County Mayo. There are selfies of them walking by a frozen-over Regent's Canal and swimming in the lakes on Hampstead Heath. She always assumed she loved him far more than he loved her, but he has also taken pictures of her without her knowing, sleeping and cooking and dancing to the radio. There are some blurred close-ups of her gazing thoughtfully into the middle distance or smiling at someone he has cut out of the frame. It was a mistake to do this, to remind herself what she's lost. She closes down the iPad and turns instead to the documents that fill the rest of the box. She draws out Finn's birth certificate and First Communion card, both inscribed with the middle name he hated so much he wouldn't reveal it. Well, now she knows. Ambrose. This makes her smile, despite her other feelings. He kept their marriage certificate because he was afraid she would change her name after they split up. He has his parents' marriage certificate too, along with the will from the aunt who left him the house where they lived. He always spoke in reverential terms about Aunt Bernadette, crossing himself and gazing heavenwards, only half in jest, whenever her name was mentioned. Next to that, she discovers a rarity, a photograph actually printed on paper. It shows Finn as a child, standing in front of 221 Baker Street. Even though he can be no more than 6 or 7, she instantly recognizes the wicked grin and those bright blue eyes of his. But there's something strange. The front door of the house is open, and she can see the hall. A flight of steps leads up to the first floor, just as it does now. But on the right-hand side, before the staircase, a door opens into a downstairs room. But that's impossible. The downstairs room doesn't exist. Could it have been closed off? Is this actually her house? She lays the photo down. There's not much left in the box. Out comes a well-thumbed Marvel comic, The Adventures of Turfman, a brightly crayon drawing of a T-Rex signed with the letters FAH in a childish scrawl, and a letter from someone called Annie, written in a shaky child's hand, asking Finn to marry her so they can kiss without going to hell. Only one item remains. A folded piece of paper, yellowed with age, tucked inside a clear plastic file. She slides it out, opens it, and spreads it over the photographs. It is the plans to a large, three-story townhouse. The layout is similar to Baker Street, but for the fact that, on the other side of the stairs, there is a full set of extra rooms. The ground floor has an additional parlour. The drawing room on the first is double the size, and the second floor has extra bedrooms, labelled servants' quarters. Could the wealthy Aunt Bernadette have owned a second, larger house in Baker Street? Missy's eye moves to the inscription at the bottom of the page. She blinks and looks again. The plans are for 221 Baker Street. They were drawn up in 1867 when the house was built. So what happened to the other rooms? She's not sure why this question plays on her mind as she repacks the box. Perhaps it's what Holmes said when he first heard about the threats. It's possible that there's something in the house that they want. Could these plans show what that thing is? She's examined them minutely, but if they do reveal anything important, it's beyond her to see it. But not beyond Holmes. If she tells Susan, there'll be an argument. Susan won't want her to go. She'll say it's too dangerous. But Missy has already made up her mind. She scribbles a note saying that she has been forced to return briefly to London and promises to be careful, then grabs her coat and tucks the rolled plans in the pocket. Creeping down the stairs, she slips out through the back door of the Black Swan and heads for the station. That morning, Lestrade and Hopkins find themselves entering the second skyscraper that they have visited in a single week. The Shard may be older and several stories shorter than the Ark, but it also has the feeling of permanence and familiarity that comes with age. Built at the start of the 21st century, as long ago as 2009 to be precise, it has since found itself surrounded by young pretenders. It's easy to forget that in its time it was considered revolutionary, built by Qatar money, loved and hated in equal measure. Today it just feels over-familiar. The lift does not speak to them as they travel upwards. Nor, in fact, does the PA who meets them on the 12th floor. Apart from the briefest good morning, she is tight-lipped as she leads them down the corridor to the same conference room where Mycroft met his executive partners just the day before. The man they have come to meet is not yet there. "Do you have mobile phones?" the PA asks. "Yes," Hopkins says, already uncomfortable, not liking the girl's attitude. The PA walks over to an expensive wooden box with inlaid ivory patterns and a lock missing its key. Lestrade had noticed it when they came in, as it is the only ornament in the room. A tea chest. She opens it. "Could I ask you to place them in here?" she says. "Why?" Hopkins is recalcitrant. "Company policy?" She smiles sweetly. Lestrade does not want an argument, certainly not with this girl. He does what he's asked, noticing the lead lining inside. He guesses that it is a modern addition, added perhaps 100 years after the tea chest was made. Hopkins gets the message and does the same. "Mr. Bloor will be with you in a minute," the PA says. "Can I bring you tea or coffee?" "We're fine, thank you," Lestrade says. He would like a coffee, but there is something about this place, about biogenesis, about the girl even, that makes him unwilling to accept any hospitality. In fact, Bloor deliberately keeps them waiting for 10 minutes. Lestrade and Hopkins sit at the table but do not speak. They have already rehearsed this interview, and there will be plenty of time for a post-mortem later. Eventually the door opens, and a large, hairless man hurries in with a sense of controlled anger that immediately tells them that he has no time for the police, and that this meeting is nothing more than an inconvenience. He places his own mobile phone in the tea chest, which is interesting. Then he sits down.
"Good morning, gentlemen," he begins. "My name is Jonathan Bloor, and I am the COO of Biogenesis. I'm sorry to have kept you waiting, but you are calling at a particularly difficult time. and I'm afraid I must ask you to make this interview as short as possible.
It will be as short or as long as it needs to be, Mr. Bloor, Lestrade replies, reasonably. But I'd be interested to know why this morning is more difficult than any other.
Bloor reacts with a hint of annoyance. He had wanted to intimidate the two police officers. Instead, he may have inadvertently given too much away.
We are having technical issues with some of our computers, he says. They're having to be taken away for maintenance. It's actually quite routine, but it still requires a shutdown of around 20% of our systems, with an obvious knock-on effect.
He pauses. How can I help you?
My name is Lestrade. This is Detective Inspector Hopkins. We're here because of the death of a major industrialist by the name of Dost Akbar. Were you acquainted with him?
Bloor gives nothing away, but of course the name has an impact on him. So that's why they're here.
But why? How much do they know? Should he lie?
No.
If they're asking, it's because they already know.
I had met him on one or two occasions, he replies, and of course I was extremely sorry to hear of his death. I imagine that Mr. Akbar was under a great deal of stress following the loss of his aircraft with its passengers and crew.
Actually, sir, we do not believe that the destruction of Eastern Airlines Flight 356 was the reason Mr. Akbar took his own life. At least we do not believe he killed himself out of a sense of guilt or remorse.
Lestrade allows this to sink in.
He left a message, he adds, simply.
A suicide letter?
No, sir. A red circle.
Would that mean anything to you?
Why would it?
We wondered if it might represent an organization of some sort.
I'm afraid I can't help you, Chief Inspector. A red circle, a blue circle, any circle. It hardly sounds like a message from a man considering taking his own life.
You may be right, sir, but there's something else we don't understand. We have been looking into the finances of Mr. Akbar and have noticed that he was making monthly payments directly to Biogenesis.
£50,000, Hopkins mutters.
Paid monthly for several years.
Can you explain these generous sums, Mr. Bloor?
Jonathan Bloor can explain them very simply. The blackmail demands. Each company paid the sum required directly to an account held in escrow by Biogenesis.
These were then passed on to the Red Circle. It was meant to simplify things, to heighten security. It also allowed Mycroft to check that the various organizations had not defaulted. But it's come back to bite them now.
I'm sorry, I'd have to talk to our financial manager,
Bloor deadpans.
Is he in the building today, sir?
I'm sorry, it's her annual leave. I'll ask her to contact you the moment she returns.
I'm surprised that one woman runs the financial department of a company as extensive as Biogenesis, Lestrade says, sidestepping the supposed sexism.
She doesn't. She has a team of over 100 people, but I wouldn't know which of them to approach for the information you're asking.
Lestrade tries a different tack.
Mr. Akbar regularly attended a meeting at this office. It was called the Summit.
Bloor flinches.
That's highly confidential. Who told you that?
We spoke to his personal assistant in New York. She said that he had been invited to another summit, which would have taken place just a couple of weeks after he killed himself. She suggested that it might have contributed to his death, that he was extremely nervous about attending.
What? And so he scribbled a red circle on a sheet of paper to tell you this?
Now Bloor is mocking them.
Almost 400 people died in Richmond Park, Mr. Bloor. Our investigation has concluded that the destruction of Flight 356 was not an accident. It was brought down deliberately in an act of terrorism. Has Biogenesis been threatened by an organization calling itself the Red Circle or something similar?
There is a heartbeat of silence, but Bloor doesn't blink.
That is a ridiculous assertion, Chief Inspector. If we had received a threat of any sort, we would quite naturally have approached the police. Would have been in our interest, wouldn't you say?
He gets to his feet.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to terminate this interview.
You're too busy for us, Hopkins sneers.
No, Detective Inspector Hopkins, but given the tone and direction that your questions have taken, I do not think it would be a good idea to continue without our legal department being present. I'm sure you understand.
Lestrade also rises. We can come back at your convenience, Mr. Bloor.
And maybe we can talk to your financial department at the same time.
Certainly.
Lestrade walks over to the tea chest. Let's not forget our mobile phones, he says. Neither Lestrade nor Hopkins speak until they have left the building, but once they are a safe distance away, Lestrade cannot hide his excitement.
The tea chest, he exclaims. Did you see? It was lead-lined, Hopkins says.
Yes. He was afraid that our phones would be hacked. There were no computers in that room, nothing electric, and even the lights. I'd swear they were either battery-operated or on some sort of local circuit. What does that make you think?
Flight 356 may have been hacked.
Exactly. We heard the final recording when we were outside that tent with the AAIB. The autopilot was out of control. There was nothing the pilots could do as they were brought down and smashed into the ground. That's why Dost Akbar was so afraid. And these people at Biogenesis are the same.
They're being hacked?
Yes. Lestrade's eyes narrow. Do you remember that business at Canary Wharf?
Canary Wharf?
It takes Hopkins a few moments to catch up.
That was a very long time ago,
he says in self-defense.
Harry and Samuel Webb.
They got 5 years, Lestrade says.
They didn't kill anyone.
They'll have been out for a while. Maybe they decided to go back to their old tricks. Now it's Hopkins who's excited.
He quickens his pace. I'll get onto it straight away, sir.
There's a soft vibration beneath their feet, and although both men feel it, neither of them comments. There is nothing unusual about it. They both know that there is a railway station beneath the Shard. A train has just pulled in.